I'm ready. We can just go live. Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast, December 3rd, 2015. We were just discussing this shooting, people being shot, human beings who don't want to die, ostensibly, having no problem removing other people of the burden of life. And Robin, you were just saying, it's hard not to be suspicious of people now, which is exactly what, well, not exactly, but it's part of what terrorists want, right?
Right. I mean, this has done so much damage beyond the people that were killed and beyond the people that were injured, because the shooter was born in the United States and he was working at a job for 5 years, and people liked him and didn't suspect him, you know, of anything like this. And to think that a person who, you know, you're working side by side with for 5 years and you have no idea, and then one day they come to work with bombs and they intend to blow the place up, and then the bombs didn't go off, so they shot everyone.
Oh, that's how it went? They were intending to use the bombs, and the bombs didn't work?
They went to a holiday party, and they had the husband. He went to the holiday party at this place that he worked, and they brought
him
bombs.
The wife didn't go with him?
No, it was during the work day. Okay. This all happened at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, dear.
So it was, some sort of a holiday luncheon at the workplace, and apparently he brought bombs. They found bombs there, but they didn't go off. So he left and apparently came back with his wife, and they shot people. And yeah, lots of people dead, lots of people injured. But it's, you know, no matter how much you want this not to have happened, it's just hard to, you know, not worry about it, not, you know, think about it when here's a situation where somebody, you know, born in the U.S. and working and happy at a job and everybody likes him, and in his head, you know, he's radicalized and planning mm-hmm. to kill people.
Mm-hmm. It's not even crazy in the ordinary sense of the word, right? Probably a person who has empathy, who has the ability to be kind and generous and has good qualities. And not because he's crazy has given these up, but because he has been, as you say, radicalized, which, you know, I don't particularly, scientifically it would just be someone who has accepted views that are crazy.
Extremist.
I mean, it's not even extremist, because it's not like more than most people. It's views that are absurd. Views that are totally out of whack with reality, out of whack with what is good. So it's, I mean, the whole radical extreme it's not quite scientific enough. It's categorically different from views of, say, the Muslims who responded to this, and I was actually happy with, who said, who talked about the sanctity of life. See, it's, when I was complaining earlier, it was about the lack of language. You know, do you really oppose this? You know, you say, I oppose. What do you believe in then? Because as soon as you say something like the sanctity of life, like, I believe that people should not be killing people, period. You know, killing is not a part of the equation. That's a good thing, right? Then there's, so that's a view that we should promote, and we should say, great, let's hold all religious people to account. Let's not have war, let's not have killing, let's not have any kind of murder. No? And so that's a kind of a view that is categorically different from the views that these people were being given and were coming to accept, views that murder in cold blood of people who did not deserve it by any standard definition of the word deserve. You know, it's not like they were targeting soldiers or politicians, you know, or something that would still be horrific, but at least somehow logical in a sense. You know, they're targeting innocent, right? I mean, these were not
co-workers.
Just co-workers.
Yeah.
You know, better than innocents, these were friends.
Right? Yeah.
People who probably treated this guy fairly well.
Yeah, that was what's being reported, that he was well-liked. You know, it's so different than what, you know, so often with these mass shootings, it's a loner, it's someone who, you know, really is isolated and, you know, problematic all around. So, but this was apparently a nice guy.
Now, maybe he was crazy. Maybe he did have some crazy, but ostensibly that's not it. Ostensibly he was a sane person who, you know, the evil of wrong view. It can be a slippery slope where it starts off with, you know, just kind of appreciation of God, who is above the world. And because God is above the world, you don't have to worry about the way things happen. I mean, Hinduism to some extent gets into trouble there as well, not to this extent, but Hinduism says things like the world is just a dream, you know, it's just illusion. When you kill someone, there's a sense and there's an interpretation that you know, killing, if you're doing it as a job, it really means nothing, because in the end, the good people go to heaven no matter what side they were on. So you do your duty, you kill each other in battle, but in the end, God sorts it all out, kind of thing. So these kind of views, that God is higher and that the world is not really consequential. They're dangerous. To say that the world is not consequential, there's a lot of people who believe that. What happens in the world, all of this is just a game in the end. What's important is this eternal afterlife, right? I mean, Hinduism isn't like that, but Islam and Christianity, I think, I'm not sure about Islam, but I understand they have an idea of an afterlife. They have strange things about people being resurrected or something. Yeah. But the idea that the world is inconsequential, it's a very dangerous one, very dangerous view that Buddhism is completely against. We're very much the opposite. This world is extremely consequential. If you want to talk about the afterlife, it depends very much on this life. You're not going to have virgins waiting for you if you are a horrible, horrible person.
Yes, it's just becoming numbing here. They had some statistics on the news. They were defining mass shootings as any shootings where four or more people were injured or killed. And they reported 355 so far this year in the United States, more than one per day.
Wow. 355.
355.
No, it's not. The year isn't over yet.
Right.
And I guess compared to other countries, that's very, very high. Because I don't think we have that in Canada.
Yeah. I mean, the really big ones, it's numbing. It was just last week with the Planned Parenthood, and you don't even make it through a week, it feels
like.
Who
was ostensibly Christian, no?
I don't know if he was specifically identified as Christian, but he was saying no more baby parts.
That's interesting. Why wasn't he identified, whether he was a Christian or not? Because they were very quick to point out, you know, these guys were Muslims, right?
Yeah.
But let's not be hypocrites. So let's call out the Christians as well. They can be just as crazy.
He might not have been Christian, though. He might have just been...
Yeah, sure. But sure. No, he may not have been. It's true. But that's a good point. My guess is he was. But, I mean, if you're not Christian, how can you get so crazy about it?
Well, apparently he was upset about the idea of selling the baby parts with...
Yeah, but the only reason people care is because they're Christian. I mean, we would care as well because we're Buddhist, but we wouldn't try and go out of our way to change other people. can only change yourself. Anyway, on to maybe more uplifting things. McMaster University is holding a TEDx conference.
Oh, cool.
Do you know TED? You know TED, right?
Yes.
So, I picked up an application thing, and they want me to submit a 1-minute video about something I'm excited about.
Do they know, as a Buddhist monk, you're not really supposed to be excited about anything?
Yeah, that's just the wording, you know.
It's a joke.
We'll adapt. You can use the words, because that's what they use, and they would be upset if we didn't use them. Not exactly, but you know, they expect us to be upset, and if we said, oh no, excitement is problematic, then they would get kind of uncomfortable. So we will humor them.
Yes.
And we won't be excited, but we'll say, maybe use different wording. I'm passionate about, that's even worse, isn't it?
Oh, that's much worse, yes. No, use the Pali words for, what's the good Pali word that means, you know, focused and resolved?
Resolved upon, yeah. But I'm pretty sure I know what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about enlightenment in the digital age. This is my big topic, because my life has been, and the topic is the paradox of change, which is kind of weird. And I think they're misusing the word paradox, you know, as people often do. It's a hard word to use and understand, I think, and people misuse it, because change isn't a paradox. Although maybe it is. See, I'm not even sure how you use this word. But the point being that change can be exciting, good, but it can also be scary, bad, right? That's what she explained to me. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem like a paradox to me, but maybe it is. Like, a paradox is a statement that contradicts itself, right? A statement that, like, this statement is false, is, as I understand, a paradox. Because that statement can't be true and it can't be false. It's a statement that can't, that defies logic, kind of. Is a paradox, as I understand.
I'd have to look it up, because I think I get it mixed up with quandary.
A paradox is self-contradicting or something. Like, I understand, if I say, this statement is false, that doesn't work, right? Because if that statement is true, then that statement is false. But if that statement is false, then that statement is true. Do you get it?
That's a paradox?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
So that is different than a quandary.
A quandary just means a problem. A dilemma. Paradox is specific. So anyway, the point being, it's about contrast, right? Or things being both good and bad, basically, as I understood her. So, you know, somehow trying to relate all this to my thing, I thought I'd talk about how I've been. My life has been a series of contradictions. I was thinking I was born in the forest, but we were one of the first people. We were among the first adopters of a computer. So when I was 6 years old, I had a computer. I was born, raised Jewish, but I became a Taoist in high school. I always did very, very well in school, and yet I wanted to drop out and practice spirituality in grade 11. And so I'm trying to work up, I have to, you know, refine it, but work up to talking about, What happened?
Welcome back, Bhante. You seem to have disconnected for a...
Yeah, it looks like my internet went kaput. Just for a moment. Am I here? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, where did I get to? I was talking about how my life, series of contradictions. And so the idea is to work up eventually to the idea of being a Buddhist monk who's, you know, lived in a straw hut on an island in the middle of a lake, who's lived on a mat in the forest, at the same time as, you know, has over 1,000 videos on YouTube, teaches meditation it's teaching meditation, but is involved in the online. And so the idea of the juxtaposition between meditation practice and the internet and the digital age, and you know, talking about how eventually the bulk of the talk being about how we can use these technologies that seem so designed to distract us and pull us away from spirituality. We can use them for spirituality. They can actually be tools for enlightenment. That's the talk, that's the idea. Sound good?
It does sound good. How long do you have to talk?
Well, they want a 1-minute video just as a test. But the talk itself, I guess, what are they, half an hour? No? Maybe not. Guess not. Probably not that long. 10 minutes? 20 minutes?
Somewhere between 10 and 20, I
Yeah,
think.
10 and 20, right. Which is nothing, really.
After buying it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can work that out. It's February 28th is when they're actually doing it, but it's a selection process, so I might get booted if there's better people than me. I mean, they want university students. I may not fit the model. I'm not exactly your model university student.
Are there model universities?
Well, they're much younger, I suppose.
Isn't McMaster, doesn't it have all ages?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yes.
Pretty diverse.
This is true.
Yeah.
In my linguistics class, there's a mother of two, and both her children are autistic. Mm. I did something that I maybe shouldn't have today. And I'm really bad at this, because secrets have never been my thing. In a bad way sometimes. You know, you like, gossiping about people is not good. Buddha said, and it's a big deal, but I often just, you know, will say things, not thinking. But this wasn't exactly gossip. Someone's TA broke down in class, and they told me about it, and they told me several other things about that were in confidence, but this was sort of a public thing, you know. And so I told my TA, who was, because we were in the same class, but we have different TAs, different teacher's assistants, because they're friends, and I thought, well, he can help. But then my friend got upset because I betrayed her confidence and so on. And so she called me just before I got on radio here. It's interesting, this idea of confidence. If someone tells you something in confidence, sometimes we may value that too much, you know? When breaking confidence can really help. I mean, obviously, if you break confidence, sometimes it really hurts people because they feel betrayed. But I wasn't really breaking confidence because it was a public thing. This person had a public breakdown. So I said to my TA, I said, yeah, one of my friend's TAs had a breakdown. And I said, even, you know, you think the person who is in that position, we think of them as like together, you know. I said, even the TAs can. And he said, well, who was it? Was it a philosophy TA? And I didn't want to tell him at first, but then I thought, well, then he said, oh, I just feel somehow like responsible. These are my friends, you know, want to help. And so I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, I really probably should tell him so he can help. It's eye-opening, no? Going to university and seeing how, I guess I knew, you know, it was, it just, it's not that big of a surprise, but still it's, it really, it's, it makes things real. Watching people struggle, having panic attacks and anxiety attacks and depression, and contemplating suicide even, you know.
It's like that. It can be like that in the workplace as well. I watched that in our industry, because in our industry it's getting smaller and smaller, newspaper industry, and where I am, for years, that, you know, they just routinely lay people off who have worked there for a very long time. You know, sometimes they've worked there their whole lives and they're not really prepared to do much else, and people get so upset and, you know, just worrying that they'll be the next to go.
Oh, and we were talking, right, about people having to train people to replace them. Like part of your contract, we're going to fire you, but first you have to train the person who's going to do your job.
Yeah.
That's just, to me, that's inhumane. That should be against the law.
Yeah, but things like that happen.
No humanity. We're losing our humanity. That's dangerous. Many of these things are showing that we're losing our humanity. The whole thing going on with people killing each other. We don't have this, you know what they talk about, it's, I don't want to say it, but it really is an apt phrase, moral compass. You know, most people would use that to talk about God, right? But having a moral compass is important. People don't like the word moral, maybe ethical compass sounds better, I don't know. But a compass is important. Something to orient yourself with. You know, we start to say, well, why is killing wrong? What's the problem with it? There's this book Crime and Punishment. He asks basically that, you know. He says, couldn't I get away with it? Or it's at least worth testing, right? And so he tests it. But then he realizes the test was a big mistake, because not only was he not be above it, but it was far more horrific to kill someone than he thought. When when these two planes went into the World Trade Towers in New York,
yes,
I was doing walking meditation when I heard about it, and then that day, later that day, we went to see my Tsia Jantong, and we had a translator, and we were asking, someone was asking about it, one of the Western meditators was asking what he thought about it, and he said, it was silly kind of, but he said, if they had been meditating, they would have never done that.
It's true.
Yeah. Which, you know, why I bring it up is because that's exactly what I would say about all this. It's, people are blind, you know. If you meditate, you could never do that. So it points to what we're lacking, really. We're lacking some clarity and perspective, grounding in reality. You know, this being uprooted from reality, being cut off from reality, living in the past and the future. Religion does a lot of that, you know, living in the past and the future, now that I think about it. How much of religion is about, how much of the war in the Middle East is about living in the past, right? This was our land. No, it was our land. Well, it was our land first. Well, you took it from us last. Or, you know, I mean, this was promised to us. I mean, that's a whole other thing. That's not really past. That's the whole, my friend showed me a documentary where these Jewish people, they were asked whether they think Muslims are and Jews are equal. And he said, he thought about it for a second. He said, no, Jews are chosen. Jews are the chosen people.
According to Jews, right?
Yeah, conveniently. Now, if the Quran said that the Jews were chosen people, then you'd maybe have something, right? Both sides agreed. But it's not really evidence, right? If the defense, I don't know. That's the thing about appeal to authority. Both sides have to agree on the authority, otherwise it's meaningless. And then worry about the future, right? The future, many religions have this prophetic vision of the apocalyptic future. The Jews have it, the Christians have it. The Jews have it? No, the Jews, I don't, maybe have it. Some of their books are prophetic about the future, but maybe not so much. Jewish Judaism is much more about the past. And about this righteousness of being the chosen people, which is ridiculous. My God, can you imagine, you know? We're special under God. Talk about ego. That's wrong. So this is the thing. We can't just talk about religion as though it's harmless and as though it's fine and that all religions teach people to be good people. It's just not true. They teach people a lot of weird and wacky things that lead to war, conflict, and cruelty, evil. I mean, we shouldn't say these. I would never want to say such a thing on the internet, but, you know. Well, we're in private here. Someone posted a comment recently and said, you're very brave to say these things about Islam. Maybe stupid is a better word. I mean, not stupid, but just oblivious. I don't think about it. But on the other hand, that's a good point as well. Should we be afraid? I think no. You know, in Cambodia, during the Khmer Rouge, Mahagosananda, this famous or fairly famous, quasi-famous Buddhist monk, took people and went on walks through the battlefield in between soldiers shooting at each other. He took people on peace walks. I mean, that's the kind of fearlessness we need. People to wake up, because part of the waking up is not to be afraid of death. And people can't terrorize you if you're not afraid, right? I think that's important. I don't think we should be afraid. I don't think we should. I think we should live our lives as we always have. And have this as a wake-up call. Yeah, I could die at any moment, a horrific death. Far worse than many of these people have suffered. I could be tortured. I could have my limbs sawed off by bandits, by terrorists. But the Buddha still said, if you get angry at them for that reason, you're not following my teachings. So, you know, rise above that. That's how far we have to go. It's a real good wake-up call. So in a sense, it's just Buddhisms are about rising above, but in a very different way, you know, rising above our attachments. And then, you know, then you can't be, then you're impervious to these things. I mean, terrorism can't work unless you can scare people. To me, everyone dies. All of those people who died, well, you know, they were going to die anyway. Just was a little bit different than most of us. And that seems kind of heartless and awful, I suppose, but if we can see it that way, that's really the only answer, because you can't control. You can't be sure that you're not going to be the next victim. We can't stop it. You know, they can pass all these laws and whatever, but and just gonna, it's been since the humans began, and it's going to be until we burn to a crisp and the whole earth burns up and there are no more humans, and then it'll all happen again apparently. It's exciting. It's a cycle, good for us, again and again and again.
I take some consolation, and hopefully our own sila protects us more than the laws.
Yeah. Sila protects you. Dhamma protects you. Dhammo havai rakkhati dhammacari. But it protects you differently. I told this to a man once when I was in Thailand, and he said, "Yeah, I thought that once, and I was believing that." And I used to, he said, I was meditating on a bus, and he said I was sitting full lotus on the bus, and I had this idea, you know, the Dhamma will protect me. And then the bus hit some kind of a bump, and he actually like dislocated his leg or something like that. So he had this idea that if he was meditating, if he was practicing the Dhamma, he would always be protected. But I said to him, well, it's not really that kind of protection, not all the time anyway. That's not really the point. The point is protecting your mind, which obviously was not well protected because you got upset about it. So the Dhamma protects you absolutely, completely. It doesn't protect your body. It's not like body armor or something. Although, you know, there are stories of how it is, right? We've had a couple of stories recently. Apparently it can be, but that's not really the protection. True protection is not physical. True protection is mental. Do we have any questions this evening? We've been chatting for a half an hour.
Yes, let's check.
Good things. No questions?
No, I think we do. Let's see. Hello, Bhante. I have heard you sometimes say it's not important how long one meditates. Important is the quality of the meditation. What are exactly the characteristics of a good quality meditation? Thank you.
It lasts a moment. That's the first important quality, and you have to drive that home to yourself. Meditation isn't more than one moment at a time, which just makes it a lot more difficult. We're lazy, you see. You want an answer, and we all want an answer about what I can do, one answer for the whole hour, you know, so that I can really make it, just have to do one thing, and then I have an hour of good meditation. Right? We really feel that that's how it should be, that we shouldn't have to work every moment. It's not pleasing for us to hear that actually, you're going to have to do the work every single freaking moment of that hour if you want to have an hour worth of meditation. That's not pleasing to us. But that's the truth. If you want to have an hour's worth of meditation, you're going to have to do work every moment for an hour. So that sounds arduous to us because we live in the future. We think, oh my gosh, I've got to do this for an hour. But it's actually quite peaceful if you're every moment just in the moment. It's powerful, but it's not easy. Most of us are too lazy for that. So we have to work. We have to lift ourselves up. We have to bring ourselves back again and again and again and again. But that's what it means. Good meditation is only one moment. It can't last more than a moment. That moment you're mindful, then it's gone. Next moment, are you mindful? It's up to you. You can just stop, and usually do, and then get lost, and finally you come back and maybe you have another moment of mindfulness. But it's back and forth and back and forth. So that's important because you shouldn't have any concept of my meditation was good that hour, my meditation was bad that hour. It's only in that moment. It's only one moment. Don't think about meditation as good, as bad, as better, as getting better, as getting worse. That shows that your mind is in the wrong place, because your mind should only be in one moment. If anyone asks you, how's your meditation, you shouldn't even be able to really answer. You can't really give an answer because, well, it was different at every moment. That's a good answer. I did an hour of meditation. Oh, how was it? Oh, it was different every moment. Ali is here. We should get Ali on our hangout to talk about this. Ali, would you come on and talk to us? Is he still here? He's gone.
I don't see Ali signed. Well, sometimes when people are logged in, I think if their screen is inactive or something.
He might be on YouTube. Ali, if you're watching, come on back to meditation.srimangalo.org. Here you are. Yeah, come on. Click on that link and come on the air. He's got something to say, I'm sure. He should have been here since the beginning at 9. Now, Ali has done a TEDx talk, so he can give me advice on that as well. Okay, 1 minute, he says.
Okay. I think there was another question, maybe a 1 minute question.
Now, people are not using the queue, are they?
Yes. It's right below. What is a thought? Does it refer to verbal inner speech only? What about simply recognizing an object we see, or a person's voice, or our name?
Yeah, I mean, the word thought is vague, right? So if it's a recognition, well, that's better a recognition. If it's a memory, well, that's a memory. So, I mean, I was asked this, probably this was the same person, maybe it's the same person who asked it to me today in interview. Maybe it was someone different, but it's an odd question because, well, the word thought just encompasses a lot of different things. But if you're talking ultimate reality, there's various kinds of things that could be called a thought. Absolutely. I mean, thinking is a thought, really. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. Sometimes it's about recognizing something. Sometimes it's about a plan you have, an idea you might have.
Thinking is thought.
Hi, Ali. You have to turn off YouTube if you're joining us. So, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, nice to see you. Ali's a good friend from from Iran.
Sometimes recognizing something, sometimes about a plan you have.
That wasn't you, Ali. We got someone else in here.
Hello.
So Ali is from Iran originally, and he's living in Winnipeg, Canada. And I just wanted to get his thoughts on, what are your thoughts on the things we were talking about in general? Any thoughts, Ali?
Yeah, I have a lot of opinion about
you. Well, anything you can say that's maybe... only mildly opinionated.
I appreciate your comment about not being afraid of speaking up about Islam or beliefs or views in general, and how they impact the behavior of people.
Right.
Because it seems to have become very fashionable to think the opposite way, thinking that circumstances all the time, circumstances or the conditions are the only thing that affects people's behavior, and beliefs and views have no...
Right. You must hear a lot of that. Oh, it's because these people are in hard times and oppressed and so on.
Mm.
When it's not the only reason. You know? Yeah. As Sam Harris says, you don't see Tibetan Jain suicide bombers, or maybe it was even. Although there's an argument to be made there, because people under duress will do things they wouldn't normally do. So absolutely, that is a cause. It's just. It's an important point that it isn't the only cause. People can be driven to insanity, not insanity, but to do horrific things by you know, views and opinions when circumstances certainly don't warrant it.
Mm. Yeah, so I think this is the more people, like rational, open-minded people actually speak about this issue, I think the better chance of actually tackling it in a right way, because right now the people who are, you would describe as liberals or progressives, they avoid talking about the issue because of the fear of being called Islamophobes or racists or actually being attacked by the Islamists. And the only people who actually criticize Islamists are, you know, bigots, seems like, at the moment. So we need people, like people with moderate views to speak about this critically, not out of identity politics.
Yeah, you can't give a religion a carte blanche just because they're being attacked or oppressed. I mean, yes, it's wrong to be bigoted and just be against someone, simply against people, simply because of their religion, or even really to just be against a religion wholesale. But that doesn't mean, and you know, I think we both completely agree with the people who are saying this, ideas have to be challenged, have to be open to be challenged. You have to be able to challenge ideas, absolutely, every idea. So a religion doesn't get a free pass just to say, oh, well, that's your religion. That's horse puckies. Now, on the other hand, as Buddhists, we don't go around attacking people for their views, but we have to call a spade a spade, meaning we have to call it what it is. And I think it's important to come out and say that. Now, as you say about not being afraid, well, it's interesting, you know. If expressing your views is, I mean, you do have to look at the consequences to some extent. I mean, you don't. It is kind of brash to just come out and. Suppose you're in a situation, suppose I lived in Iran, I wouldn't say, oh, well, whatever, I have to speak out, right? Because I would know that, you know, practically speaking, speaking out is too much, is just suicide, or, you know, I mean, maybe not in Iran, but in some places in the world. So you do have to consider that, I think. Even a Buddhist will consider the practicality of sticking their neck out. I think even more importantly, what we can say, I think, without much doubt, is we have to learn not to be afraid of dying. In general, whether we're afraid of speaking out or not, I don't think it's. I think everyone has to be speaking out or forming views on these things. You know, who's right, who's wrong? Is Islam a horrible thing? You don't have to have that. That's not. I mean, what's important is, and I think clearly important, and made clear by this, when people threaten you, to learn not to be afraid of that, to not let people. Not let the evil win.
What's interesting is that all these suicide bombers are also not afraid of dying. It's but finding a balance is very critical, right?
But the argument I could make is that makes them more powerful than us. That's the power they have over us, and that shows how powerful it is. It doesn't show that not being afraid of evil is evil, not being afraid of death is evil. I don't think it is. I think it's very powerful. And that's what's so powerful about religion. Religion is an incredible power. These people are very powerful for evil. No, it's just that their religion teaches messed up things. But Buddhists, there's a lot of that about not being afraid of dying, you know, meditating without fear of death. It's the power of religion. Many secular society has trouble giving you that kind of power, because you don't believe in it, right?
Exactly. And the notion of faith or belief is so, because it seems to me that people who are in charge in most of the secular societies are not believers themselves, so they don't understand what it means to believe something,
right.
And they make all these wrong-headed decisions about how to
have
religion.
Right. We'll just make life better for people, and they'll smarten up. Well, no, not really. Not if you as you say, if you believe in something.
So most of these terrorists are well educated, middle income families, or even higher. It's not about education or lack of education or poverty. They do contribute, but what really matters most, in my opinion, is what people believe. If you really believe that you will live in heaven for eternity if you do jihad, then doing jihad is the most sensible thing that you
right.
do.
And it's inconsequential, the people who suffer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I read this conversation from Taliban had attacked a children's school in Afghanistan, and somebody was arguing with a Taliban sympathizer on Facebook, and why did you do that? And his answer was that if they were not guilty, they would go to heaven. So why are you? You sent them to heaven, so why are you mad at us? And it's just...
It's absurdity. You know,
yeah, if you believe that, then you are not just a malicious person. Or you might have really good intentions, but...
Right. Yeah. That's a very... It's the most dangerous thing. The Buddha said, wrong view is the worst evil. Wrong view, not only wrong view, but wrong view that is niyata, means fixed. When your view, when you're certain about your view, when you've come to a certainty about wrong view, that's the worst evil.
I feel like that's what's different, at least with insight meditation and, let's say, prayer in Islam, where in insight meditation you're constantly examining your views,
right,
moment by moment, whereas in the prayers in Abrahamic religions, at least I feel like you already have formed your belief, and you're just, you know,
you're reaffirming it, right?
Yeah.
And if someone challenges your belief, you can just decide that they are Satan, you know, trying to tempt you away from your faith. That's what we were saying yesterday, Bhante, about, you know, when people are making a good argument, that, you know, it just seems that when people are really rooted in their faith, then no matter how good your argument is, they can just simply decide that you're the devil, you're tempting them away from their faith.
Yeah, so my question now to all this, and I'm interested in what you have to say, Ali, what's the solution? $1 million question.
No pressure.
Yeah, meditation.
but how do we, I mean, obviously these people are not, most of these people will never meditate.
Yeah, it's
I mean, I guess I just mean, not that how are we going to fix the world, but how hypothetically, if suppose your spouse was suddenly started talking about jihad, about, you know, going around, let's put bombs in your workplace and shoot up all your colleagues.
At least in the societies, like free societies, like North American countries, I think what what is lacking really is the is spirituality or meaning in life. So people who are from the Islamic backgrounds,
right, they feel miss something
big hole in their life, with everyone's life, but for them, when really, like, they could make, you know, they could have good jobs, make money, but what then? So this whole of meaning is really important.
That's really insightful.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly what you see with Buddhist communities.
Yes.
Buddhists come here and they feel exactly that. And so they cling to their culture. And that's good in some ways because they cling to Buddhism. But it's the exact same feeling. And that's exactly it. If your culture has problems, then, yeah, that makes for dangerous... That's interesting. It kind of, there's a dangerous slippery slope there that it says, you know, immigrants can be inherently problematic, dangerous, because but no, you raise a different point, and that's that our society is to blame for being totally devoid of any higher thought. We're base and coarse and only interested in sensual pleasures and that kind of thing.
And kind of like I feel like the Western society has lost confidence in its values, so it's not really promoting them. So multiculturalism has this, it's very multifaceted. It can be really harmful by giving bad cultural practices the same value as tolerance or democracy, and when people from the Islamic countries have this impression that, oh, okay, they really don't have anything to offer either, so I'll go back to my own background, and unfortunately it becomes even more radical in the Western societies, because they become very literalistic. They go to the text and they take everything for the word by word by the text, and the texts are written about 1400 years ago, and they are really dangerous. So they are less dangerous if they are in the cultural context of Muslim countries, I believe.
Right, because the more time, evil teachings, this would happen with Judaism, you know, just over time you just don't pay attention, because killing people doesn't work. Stoning people to death for believing in other gods, well, you know, in the end it's not a very pleasant practice.
Yeah.
So you just stop doing it. But yeah, it's all right. When it's that's interesting, when it's out of its culture, it can become more dangerous. But, you know, all of this, we have a different angle, because at the same time we would say, you know, it's not just all that, it's that these teachings are poisonous. You know, it's one thing to say that culture will mitigate them, but it's like, why are they there in the first place?
Yes.
Your book should not say that sort of thing. If your book says that thing, you should rip it up, throw it away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But
virtually everyone's, you know, because, I mean, the Bible certainly has extremely violent and...
One problem I believe is specific to Islam is the belief that it is the Quran is infallible. It is word by word sent by God, and it has never changed historically. And a lot of Muslims believe that, and that makes interpreting it or going around it very difficult. So it's just that they have to get rid of some parts of it. I think that the honest approach is to say, okay, these parts are bad, even though people who want to still stay Muslim, and they just have to get rid of big chunks of the book, or at least believe that it's not infallible.
That's right. It's not about ripping the book up and throwing it away. It's about, but I think that's probably not what's going to happen. If we do go the right direction, what we've seen, right, is not that people come out and say this part of the book is wrong. They just try to pretend it's not there, or not talk about it, or, you know, just not follow it, which is inferior. You know, it'd be great if we could just say, agree, these parts of our books are bad, because even Buddhism is guilty of that. There are some parts of Buddhism that are problematic, the gender parts. There's parts that deal with women that are genuinely problematic to me anyway. I think some people will defend them, many people will defend them, but I don't agree. And I think some of it can be attributed to, anyway, I don't want to get too much into that, but some of it can be defended, but some of it is indefensible. And so you have to, I mean, actually, honestly, I would rather, and maybe that makes me guilty as well, but I would rather just not talk about those parts. Not just not talk about them, but let's just put those parts aside. Because, as you say, once you, there are problems associated with declaring parts to be wrong, because, well, then who gets to decide what is wrong? And what parts do you remove? And then everybody starts pulling parts out, and then you lose some of the good stuff as well, and so on. So I guess at least I can empathize with people. And you end up with a lot of enemies if you try to do that, because people have seen the good in their books. And there are good things in the Quran, right? It talks about helping poor people. It talks about whatever, you know, good things. There's good things in the Bible. So it's certainly not about throwing these books away. But, I mean, what the Christians and Jews have done, I think, is said, well, that was in context. So it was, many of those things were the best morality they had at the time in the situation. And people have said that about Islam as well, right? I mean, it was a terrible time and it was a terrible place and everyone was at war and killing each other. So you needed rules and how to deal with infidels, your enemies, right? So you can, true or not, you can justify it in that way, right? And say, okay, well, those were time and place and we're going to not tear them out of the book or censor them, but we're going to say that doesn't belong to this time and this place, which is, you know, better.
But then the question of who decides what parts belong to when, it still exists, right?
Yeah. But we might be able to deal with that, you know, if people in general start meditating and good people start looking at it in this way and talking about it in this way, and talking to moderate Muslims. I know you might not even like that word, I don't know, but I think you could say moderate Muslims, people who don't take their religion too seriously, right?
Cafeteria Muslims, they call it sometimes.
Sorry? Cafeteria Muslims?
Yeah,
right, the ones who worry about halal and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you could talk to them and maybe come to an agreement. Actually, I don't know. You know, people seem to take their religion fairly seriously. So maybe that isn't, but there may be ways that we can at least get some agreement that, you know, these teachings have to be treated with kid gloves. Kid gloves? I mean, we can't hold on to them. They have to be put at arm's length, maybe is what I mean to say. At least. Sorry, I think... Are people waiting to ask questions about meditation?
Let me check.
I mean, this is important. We're religious people, so it's important to talk about religion.
Hello, Bhante. I just had a question about addressing objects of attention. From what I understand, in Vipassana, one will shift their object of attention, but in Samatha, your object of attention is fixed. Is that right? Should one method be preferentially used over the other in certain circumstances? Should we not switch between the two on a regular basis? Thank you.
Samatha and Vipassana, or?
Yeah, switch between Samatha and Vipassana.
There are two different paths. If you're going to take Samatha, then it means focusing on a single object. But you have to understand why it is that way. Samatha focuses on a single object and Vipassana doesn't, because the objects of Vipassana don't last more than a moment. So it's not possible to focus on them, because they don't last. They arise and they cease. The objects of Samatha do last. And this is what I was trying to get at with the whole breath thing, right? Breath is something that is stable. You can watch it go in and watch it come out. And it becomes more and more stable the more you watch, and so your mind becomes tranquil. But if you watch the stomach, if you watch this tension, the actual feeling, or if you watch a feeling here, or you know, an actual feeling, and see it as the feeling, that feeling arises and ceases, and once it's gone, it's gone. But the breath is a concept. You know, what is breath? Breath is a thing that goes into your body and then comes out of your body. You breathe in and you breathe out. And there are many different kinds of samatha meditation, but what they all have in common is the object that lasts. The idea behind that is to enter into a fixed state where your mind doesn't waver from that object. And that gives you a very strong concentration. It's like it gives you a big hammer. And then you can use that, you can turn and use it on ultimate reality then. Even though the ultimate realities don't last, you'll still get that very strong concentration just for a moment. So people who have practiced samatha find benefit from it in vipassana. There's no question. Samatha is not bad. It's very good. There is an argument that people, I think, rightly make that samatha may take longer than just practicing directly vipassana. So you know, this is an ongoing argument whether you need to practice samatha first, some people think, whether you have to practice them together. But there's a good sutta, and it's always brought up by all sides of this debate, called the Yuganada Sutta, where the Buddha says sometimes people practice samatha and then vipassana, sometimes they practice vipassana first and then their mind is tranquilized, sometimes they practice them together. And then there's even a fourth way, which is kind of confusing, so I won't go into it, but there are different ways, is the point. And so I can't really answer your question, the latter part of your question, with any, you know, I can't categorically answer it, because some people do different. Some people go on to become Buddhas. So you choose.
And there was a question about how far you are from Shoreham, North York, but Anthony answered it. It's about a 40 to 50 minute drive. So that one's all set.
From where?
Shoreham, North York, to your monastery.
Shoreham.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you probably said it right. I just...
Well...
Shoreham. I know North York. I don't know Shoreham. North York is part of Toronto.
Yes, Anthony responded it's a 40 to 50 minute drive. I know this is off topic about Islam, but I was wondering what a Buddhist monk eats.
Food, mostly. Food.
Whatever is offered.
Yeah, that's true. Not whatever is offered exactly, but that's not true. Because it gives the impression that when someone offers you food, you eat it. It's not necessarily true. You might look at it and say, I'm not eating that. That's fine. That's actually allowed for many reasons. You might have many reasons for not eating it. It could be improper to eat. You know, it could be dog meat, or it could be elephant meat and lion meat. There are many kinds of meat that the Buddha said we shouldn't eat. Or it might be meat that was killed for you, in which case you absolutely shouldn't eat it. It might be unhealthy food, so you shouldn't eat it. Well, there's not really a sense, but there's kind of a sense that you shouldn't eat it. It would be ridiculous to eat it. You know, if it's just poison. It's just funny, because Buddhist monks have gotten to this idea that they have to eat this food, and so they know it's unhealthy, and yet they still eat it. Maybe that's less nowadays, but I think there is some, to some extent, you still see that they stop caring about their health because they say, well, I just have to eat whatever they give me. That's not really true. It's kind of silly, really, because then they end up with diabetes and heart disease, and they're not helping anyone.
Are they eating it to make the people who gave it happy, or right. to give them
yeah.
merit, or?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Not to offend the giver.
Right. So, okay, that is actually a valid point that you have to be careful. You don't want people to be upset. But I don't know. I'm skeptical that trumps your health, and maybe that's wrong of me. But to some extent you have to be careful about your health, because you'll be criticized otherwise. Rightfully, you know, why weren't you concerned? You knew that this was bad for you. And sometimes monks just don't know. That's very common, because the science hasn't been there. And mostly lay people also don't know, because they've never had a scientific or, you know, health background. But if you know...
It can be very hard to look at food and tell things about it. Like, sometimes, you know, I'll look up menus or the calorie counts and things of restaurant food, and it's shocking.
Mm.
You know, the calories and the fat and the salt that's in it.
Salt.
You can't tell by looking at it, so that's a tough thing to figure out.
Good point. And of course, you don't want to obsess about this. Absolutely. Mm. It's not worth obsessing over. I was just thinking, like, for deep fried foods, it's pretty clear that those aren't healthy. But no, it's just one idea that you don't have to. You can certainly, many monks, and there's nothing wrong with eating that kind of food, but I think it's valid if a monk decides not to eat it. My point. And certainly it would be ridiculous, because when you're full, you should stop eating. So you absolutely shouldn't eat everything people give you. You don't eat whatever people give you, so if they keep giving you food, you have to keep eating until you explode. Right?
There's such enormous amounts of food sometimes at temples and monasteries that are given to the monks. You just see the monks surrounded by these enormous amounts of food. So I guess you have to also get over the fact of, you know, not worry about wasting food, I would think, because there's just so much food.
Yeah, and Jan Tong talks about this. He says, there are many dhammas, you know, many teachings out there, many practices. And he said the Buddha's teaching is 84,000 teachings. He said it's like when the king eats. And he's thinking, of course, of when monks eat as well, right? So many dishes, every food imaginable. And the king looks and he just doesn't know what to eat. So you just eat a little bit. You eat just enough to live. And he said, that's what we do with the Dhamma. We don't have to learn all the Dhamma. We don't have to learn all 84,000 teachings. Just learn enough to fill us up.
I like that.
Not exactly.
Hi, Bhante. Are there hints of Buddha teaching people from other civilizations far from India?
Well, Lao Tzu is an example, I think, but it's more of the Pacheka Buddha situation. I mean, no one could teach like the Buddha. There's only the Buddha.
I'm not sure. I thought the question was actually about physically traveling very far from India when Buddha was teaching.
Like in the time of the Buddha?
Yes, I think the question is asking if, you know, Gautama Buddha himself taught people in civilization far from India.
Yeah, well, there's lots of folk stories about how he went to Thailand, how he went to Sri Lanka.
Oh, that's right, the footprints.
Yeah, and not just the footprints. Sri Lanka has a huge tradition that the Buddha brought Buddhism to Sri Lanka. Which, it's apocryphal, to say the least. Apocryphal, is that the word? Of dubious authenticity, I think that's what... apocryphal. I'm not convinced. And I'm sorry if there's Sri Lankan people listening, because they're mostly pretty clear that Buddha did go to Sri Lanka. But the Thais say he went to Thailand, and the Burmese say he went to Burma. Cambodians probably say he went to Cambodia. The Chinese probably say he went to China. I don't know. Maybe he did. Maybe he went to all these places.
Hours.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just kind of funny that we don't have record of it in the Tipitaka. But, you know, absolutely, you know, maybe he did. I don't know. The records aren't as good, so that's a point against the argument. And the fact that people like to make such things up. But it's interesting. It is kind of curious as to why people would make up, would lie about such a thing, right? Because it had to have started with an exaggeration, at least. But it can also start with, you know, you find a piece of a rock that looks like a footprint, and then you've got to explain it. And people come up with all sorts of crazy explanations. And so, like, it's funny, Sripada in Sri Lanka is also called Adam's Peak, and the Christians believe that it's where Adam, I think, it's something Christian, you know? Whether or not that was just something they made up, I don't know, but the point is, it may not have been a lie. It is a feasible hypothesis that it just came out of trying to explain something, you know?
And are part of the Chinese canons very similar to the Pali canons? Not all of it, but I had heard that parts of it were.
Yeah. I mean, it comes from the same source, except it was in Sanskrit, and the Sanskrit was translated into Chinese, and so all we have left now of that is the Chinese version of the Sanskrit from different schools, so some of the teachings are a bit different. But I mean, what you can say about the Pali is it's a lot less, it feels a lot more authentic. I think most scholars agree, most of them agree that or believe that Pali Tipitaka isn't the original teachings of the Buddha, and it was only the teachings of one school, but it is the best one that we have left. Like you look at the Chinese, the differences, from what I've heard, are mostly clearly, you know, kind of alterations later on the part of the Chinese version, mostly. I mean, they say Pali isn't immune to that, but the Pali version isn't immune to it, but it's less susceptible to this kind of adaptation and alteration. Right.
We're all caught up on questions.
Yeah, this idea that monks have to allow lay people to make merit actually isn't borne out by the texts. Monks would often refuse things like robes. But we've talked about this before. It's curious because some monks wouldn't, and it seems like different monks had different characters, even different arahants. Ananda would accept 500 monks of 500 robes. And he got called out for it, but he explained it very well, and he said he was sharing it with all the other monks, and they would use their old robes that were being replaced to make underrobes. They would use their old underrobes to make patches for their cloth. They would use their old patches to make bandages. They would use their old bandages to make thread. They would use their old thread to make bricks, mixing it with mud. He said, "We don't waste anything." And so the king who was criticizing Ananda for taking 500 robes gave him another 500. And Ananda accepted them. Even though a monk is only allowed to have one set, he accepted 1,000 sets. I mean, which often just means a large number. They always use 500, so I think that's often an exaggeration. So a large number of robes. Hey, maybe 500. How many did we give to Ajahn Tong?
That was
118 or something.
Yeah, either 108 or 111, some special number, I think.
So it's not unforeseeable that they got 1,000. It's a big number, but it's certainly doable. But on the other hand, many monks, when offered a second set, would say, "I'm sorry, I have enough." And they would refuse food, they refuse many different things. But they're sensitive to this, and you should be sensitive to it, because we want to do good deeds, we want to promote other people to do good deeds. So if someone has a good intention, absolutely, we're very keen to help them. Sometimes it's not appropriate. You know, if someone offers you money, it's a convenient excuse to say, well, they want to make merit. Many people have argued that with me. You're not letting these people make merit. And then other monks have said to me, what are you talking about? This is making demerit, because they're helping you break the rules. They're pushing you to break rules, to go against the Buddha's teaching that monks shouldn't touch money. So how could it be merit? This is demerit that these people are doing, right?
Well, if someone gave something appropriate and the monk didn't take it, you know, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. wouldn't the merit just be earned just by the fact that you offered it? Assuming it was appropriate?
Partially. I mean, merit is all in your mind. It's all how you feel about it. So you don't have the after feeling. You don't feel good about it afterwards. And often people feel bad about it. He didn't accept it. Why didn't he accept it? They feel angry even. That is dangerous. So it's a good argument for accepting those things, just so people don't get angry at you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people don't get upset or sad, not angry, but people get sad. But there are times where you want to give, it's a good lesson for people to not cling. So very much, it points to how, as you say, merit isn't in the object itself, it's in the mind. It's in the intention. So, but that makes it very important to be very circumspect. Sometimes if you accept things, people do it out of ego and you're just feeding their ego, right? So it's very good for you to refuse. It's a good lesson for them, can be. You see? So, not that I think you have to obsess over that, but it's not something you can categorically answer and say, you should, you shouldn't. There are many reasons why one might accept or refuse. And I think for the most part you shouldn't take it too seriously as a monk, for as a person anyway. When someone gives you something, you should just be thankful and accept it and be grateful and appreciative of the goodness in that person's heart, how kind they are and generous they are. For the most part, I think that's far more important than everything else. It's just, you can't say that monks have to eat everything or you have to accept everything, because there are instances where they shouldn't and don't. Right. How's our project going?
Let's see.
How many days has it been up?
It's been up for 1 day, and $682 has been donated. Very nice.
What an awesome group of people.
Definitely.
I can't talk about money. I can't say, oh, good, good. I shouldn't even be really talking about this, probably. But
what it is, if anyone wasn't watching yesterday, we have a campaign to raise funds to have Bhante's How to Meditate book reprinted, and 1,000 copies of that, and because it doesn't cost very much to have the book reprinted, we tied it in with a second very good cause, the Children's Home in Tampa, Florida. Bhante will be down in the Tampa area at the end of December, and we'll arrange in some way that doesn't have you handling any money at all, of course, to convey that to the Children's Home on behalf of...
Hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to, because I have to figure out a way to approach my family, but I want everyone to be a part of this, right? This is, there's no limit. It's everyone who wants to do a good deed. This is just us coming together,
yes.
And your good deed is your good deed, your thing. But I also want to dedicate my part in this in terms of making a wish to do a good deed, dedicate it to my family as well. So I'm gonna, but I was just thinking in terms of giving people receipts for their support. I guess we can't really do that for everyone, can we?
We
It's a bit problematic.
Through this, because a receipt to be like for tax purposes.
No, actually, I mean from the organizer, from the charity, from the children's home, right?
Yeah, we don't have much information here.
Are we gonna just? Is it okay if we just say for to everyone that it's the thought or something? Because it would be neat if everyone could, you know, if you want to give this as a gift to someone, you say, "I did this on your behalf, and here's the official receipt."
Yes.
Can we expect that? I mean, it's a lot to ask them to have to write up lots and lots of receipts, but how does that work?
Yes, and I think that gets mixed up with, with tax purposes and things like that.
But they're a charity, aren't they?
They are, yes. So maybe it's not difficult on their part. I don't know, I hadn't really thought about that.
Maybe we should consider talking to them, because then everyone could, we could give everyone a receipt. Well, I don't know, I mean, it's not the biggest important thing is the thought, and that we're doing this together. What I can say is thank you all for having the good intentions and desire to reprint the booklet. That's awesome. I mean, I believe that this booklet is good, even though I'm the one who wrote it. I don't know how the language is, but the content I believe in very strongly. That's why I wrote the book, because I thought this is simple stuff that can just be put out there to people, and it makes it easy for people to pick up this meditation practice that I was taught by someone else. So I think it's an important thing to be able to spread. So that's great that we're doing that.
Yes.
And as for giving to children, well, this is sort of just par for the course. As human beings, we take opportunities to care for people. And I mean, for me, it's sort of how I relate to my family, and I think that's what I was sort of suggesting everyone else to get involved. Why everyone else might want to get involved is the question comes up for Christmas: how do you relate Christmas or the holiday season, the time when traditionally you give a gift to your family? How should we approach this as Buddhists? Well, the best gift you can give to someone is merit, is goodness. So let's do good things on their behalf and give them that as a gift, and dedicate it to them, and tell them that we've dedicated it to them so they can be happy. And when they're happy about us dedicating our goodness to them, then it's goodness for them. Okay. We're way over time. We're extending this now.
We'll have to give some thought to if we can, even if we can create a certificate of sorts.
No, because we don't want this to be tied with the organization, because there's a whole slew of issues there. Although the book printing, Jeff said, should be associated with the organization, right? Anyway, I don't want to get involved with that.
Living and learning.
Yeah.
All the rules of nonprofits.
Thanks, Robin, for organizing all this.
Thank you, Bhante.
Thank you, Ali, for joining us. If you're still there, if you're not, goodbye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Thanks for being on. And Kevin, who disappeared, we never got to find out what his story was.
Oh, Kevin asked a question in chat. I believe Kevin's question was regarding what does a monk eat?
Oh, okay.
So he had a chance to ask his question.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry we didn't get around to letting you actually talk. Thanks everyone for tuning in. See you all maybe tomorrow, if we don't die in the meantime. Good night.
Good night, Bhante.